Flight Bridgette is a proud media sponsor of Medevac Foundation International, a nonprofit organization that takes pride in taking care of our own in the medical transport community. Every dollar raised supports taking care of our own. Help is on the way. This programming provides tools to combat depression and PTSD in our EMS community. The annual Run to Help the Helpers event is happening now. It's a virtual run, walk, or roll. That means cycle, rollerblade, skate, scooter, or wheelchair for EMS wellness and suicide prevention. As long as you're self-powered from start to finish, you can run to help the helpers any way you want, anytime you want, anywhere you want, or for as far as you want. Sign up today at medevacfoundation.org/events and tell them help is on the way. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Mike Verkest, Dr. Jeff Jarvis, back at it once again. Doc, how are you doing today?
Mike, I am doing great. I was living my best life today, hanging out by the pool, reading some research, just in general, battling the COVIDs.
Yeah.
And I was feeling pretty good about myself until you sent me some pictures.
Yeah. We had a nice little trip. We call it the Fruit Loop up here in the just sort of east of Portland. We go out this Highway 84, we go to Hood River, and then we cut down around the Mount Hood Wilderness area and took the drone out. We got some great pictures, and we just had a great 4th of July yesterday. So it was awesome.
I am so jealous. It is so green. Just even looking at the pictures looks like the weather was gorgeous.
Yeah, it was a perfect about 67 degrees. Very windy out in the gorge, a little windy up on Mount Hood, but once we got back down, it was perfect. You know what I didn't get out of the whole thing?
What's that?
I didn't get a headache.
You didn't?
No.
Well, Mike, is that something you get very often?
You know what? I really do not get headaches. It's a funny thing. I was talking with my wife. I've actually been to the emergency department with my wife for a thunderclap headache that started with her. But myself, I don't ever really, knock on wood, get headaches. And so when I do, and if I do, I mean, they're very, very few and far apart. But if I do, I pay particular attention to those because I know I don't normally get up.
So when Michelle had the thunderclap headache, should I ask what she was doing at the time?
She wasn't doing anything. It literally came out of nowhere, and it scared the criminy out of me because she couldn't stand. She was completely disoriented. She couldn't walk. She just kept holding her head and screaming in pain. Like, I have never seen this before. And it's one thing to go on a call, but when it's your wife, wasn't super awesome. And the last thing I thought was that it was a headache, like a migraine headache. That's what she ended up. I mean, she went in, she had a CT, the whole nine yards, and everything was fine. And she ultimately got it resolved after some medications. Wasn't Haldol, I'll tell you that. You know, they gave her the usual treatment, you know, Ketorolac and shut the lights off, and we had a little quiet area, and all of her vitals were good. She had no red flags, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, but it was a very scary situation for us because I'd never dealt with that before.
How long ago was this?
Oh God, it must be 3 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. I would still call that in the relative, basically since a big paper came out about thunderclap headaches.
Yeah.
So when you say thunderclap, how quickly did the headache go from no headache at all to maximal intensity?
It seemed like it was minutes, to be honest with you.
Wow. All right. Definitely under an hour.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. No, that's not good, man.
Yeah.
So in the way back era, so we don't actually talk about this in our discussion with Dr. Lincoln today. So I'll go ahead and throw this in here. In the way back era of old CT scans, that sudden onset at maximal intensity, thundercloud headache, is a subarachnoid until proven otherwise. And actually, it still is today. But the rule used to be, even when I started practice, a CT, negative CT alone is not sufficient to rule out a bleed. And you had to follow it up with a lumbar puncture.
Oh, they did that. Yeah.
Oh, did they? Okay.
And I'm so glad you said that because, again, how my memory fades, they absolutely did that.
Okay, good. And no blood or just a few cells from a traumatic.
Yep, exactly.
Good. Yeah, so that used to be the approach. And then probably within the last 4 to 5 years, papers have come out showing if the headache is the onset of the headache is within 6 hours, and you're using a newer generation CT scan that basically means 64 slice, so really high resolution, then you are able to catch between 98.5 and 99.5 subarachnoids.
Wow.
So the question then is, how many subarachnoids are you missing that you would pick up with a lumbar puncture? And the problem with lumbar punctures is they very often are traumatic.
Sure.
And by traumatic, I don't mean traumatic for the person getting harpooned. I mean, you get blood in the taps.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, is this blood because I,
you right. know, which came first?
Right. And then that you end up with maybe some procedures you don't need or a lot of worry that you don't need. A lot of people now are going from CT to CTA, doing an angiogram, sure. looking for aneurysms. But I think the literature is pretty good that if the headache, the onset of headache is within 6 hours, a negative new generation CT comes really close to ruling it out. And about the only people that I will do a lumbar puncture on anymore is one where my pretest probability is really, really high.
Yeah.
And to be honest, my pretest probability has not been that high with a negative scan. Almost always when I'm like, that's it, there's some blood on the scan.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely an interesting situation and a scary one, but you know, the results came out, you know, she's had migraines her whole life, at least as far back as I can remember. I've been with her since we've been 16 years old. So 30 a long time ago, seventh grade.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So you've lost all your hair from that.
I certainly have. And I've gained it in other places. So
yes, that's right. Your nose is speaking to me over FaceTime.
Yeah, nose, right? Nose and ears. Yeah, it's pretty, yes. Pretty good times.
The places you trim. And by you, I mean we.
Exactly.
You know, Mike, when we're talking about headaches, I was really glad to talk about this paper today. The paper we're going to cover is about the use of haloperidol, a sister drug to my beloved droperidol.
Indeed.
And how well it works against placebo. So we're going to cover that. And in the meantime, just because I've been doing some research on headaches, I have a bibliography already prepared. I went ahead and gave a summary of the literature about treatment of headaches. But the exciting thing for me is, just like we had Dr. Kovach, where mm-hmm. we did an interview, what I did this time is I brought in Dr. Aaron Lincoln. So Dr. Lincoln is a friend of mine. I actually first met her. She reminded me of this after we finished recording. I thought I first met her when she was teaching at Temple College. And she says, no, you rude bastard. First time I met you, you taught my cardiology class.
Oh, funny.
I was an intern. I had come back to the place where I used to teach paramedics, and she was a student there. She's now a brand new, freshly minted PGY2, second year emergency medicine resident. And we went through a case study. And this is one of the things you have to do for board certification. So we went through one, and I think it is a really good way to hit the high points of a topic. But what I would really like to know, dear listeners, is what y'all think about it. I want some feedback on this. Do you like this format? Do you like the case presentation? If so, we can definitely do more of these. So please hit us up. So I am at Dr. Jeff Jarvis. Mike, how can they get you?
Yep, you can get me at Mike Verkest on Twitter. You can hit me up at MikeVerkest@flightbridgeed.com if you want to shoot me an email, or find me on Facebook, whatever. I'm around.
That's right. And that's Mike.Verkest, right?
Mike.Verkest. I thought I said that, but you know, I give my email out so many, it just comes out automatically. So maybe in my mind, I thought I said that.
You're dotless, my friend.
I need to have a dot in there.
And if you want to hit me on email, I'm jeff.jarvis@flightbridgeed.com. With that, you know what we need right now?
A little ginger?
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top. Located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Let's jump right into the sciencey part of our podcast. In the process of writing a paper with my colleagues, Dr. Rimley Crowe and soon-to-be doctor, Bryce Johnson, on EMS treatment of benign headaches. I gathered quite the bibliography on this subject. So let's quickly review what we know about treating headaches before going on to our current paper. So we know headaches are very common, and about 1 in 6 Americans experiences them at least every 3 months. Both in the emergency department and EMS, headaches make up between 1% and 3% of volumes. Despite guidelines against the use of opioids, they are the most commonly used analgesics for headaches. Emergency departments, for example, use them for their first-line therapy anywhere between 12% in academic centers and 69% of the time in community EDs. Now, as a community emergency physician, that really bothers me. My colleagues need to pick up their game and do a better job. The work we did using the ESO dataset with Bryce and Rimley found 39% of benign headaches treated by EMS were treated with opioids, and that was by far the most commonly used drug class. Now, unfortunately, most of the time, EMS just didn't treat them at all, or I might add, assess them at all. So, why shouldn't we use opioids for headaches? I mean, we know that they have a headache, you give them Dilaudid, and the headache goes away. Well, two basic reasons. One is that other things work better, and two, there are other problems with it. What kind of other problems, you ask? Well, that's a great question. We know treating migraines with opioids is associated with, and this is a long list, so let's get ready, less pain relief than the antidopaminergics, longer emergency department lengths of stay, more hospital admissions, more return ED visits for rebound headaches, worse quality of life, and higher risk of chronic migraines. In head-to-head comparisons in randomized control trials, both 10 milligrams of prochlorperazine, which is Compazine, and 10 milligrams of metoclopramide, or Reglan, had better pain relief than 1 milligram of hydromorphone, or Dilaudid. Even parenteral NSAIDs did just as well as meperidine or Demerol. Now, that's probably an indication that Demerol is a shitty drug, but it also gives you an idea that opioids are probably not the best thing for headaches. Now, the American College of Emergency Physicians, the American Headache Society, and the Canadian Headache Society all recommend against using opioids for primary treatment of atraumatic headaches. Instead, they recommend a variety of anti-dopaminergic agents, and those recommendations include metoclopramide, prochlorperazine, droperidol, and ketorolac instead of opioids. And they have some pretty good evidence for this, and we talked about some of that already. All right, so when it comes to how each of these non-opioid medications compare to each other, well, there, the evidence isn't quite so good. We know more or less all of them work, but which works best? Well, let's take a look. First off, I'm not sure entirely why someone would think to do this first study, but Kalin and his colleagues performed an RCT of a pretty healthy damn dose of promethazine, or Phenergan, at 25 milligrams IV compared to 10 milligrams of prochlorperazine. And they found that prochlorperazine, or Compazine, had faster relief, more complete headache resolution, less sedation, and the same risk of akathisias. I don't know why you would use Phenergan for headaches. Phenergan just puts you to sleep. Not necessarily bad, but it doesn't really make the headache better. Now, several papers have compared both prochlorperazine and metoclopramide to placebo and found either one of them were much better than placebo. Dr. Friedman, who's done quite a bit of work in this area, looked at dosing of metoclopramide and found that there is no difference between 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams, and 40 milligrams. Now, this was particularly a painful study for me because I had to tell my colleague, Dr. Ross Tobelman, that he was right. We got into an argument about this because I typically use 20, and he uses 10, and he called me an ignorant slut, and I immediately went to PubMed to defend my honor, and I found Friedman's paper, and I had to say that he was right. And, you know, I was wrong on this, just this one time. All right, so what else do we know? Well, Marco Coppola who happened to do this research when he was still at Scott and White, where I did my residency, he compared straight up 10 of metoclopramide to 10 of prochlorperazine, and he found more relief with prochlorperazine than either the metoclopramide or a placebo. Now, he also in that trial found metoclopramide did better than placebo, just not better than prochlorperazine. Now, there was a similar study done a long time ago that showed no difference between Compazine and Reglan, but I kind of like Coppola's paper better. Now, looking at NSAIDs, ketorolac by itself has been compared with Compazine and meperidine, that's Demerol, remember, showing equal effectiveness versus Demerol, but less effectiveness versus Compazine. Several studies have looked at droperidol, one of my favorite drugs, versus placebo and showed benefit. So one of my favorites was Minner's study in 2001. He compared 5 of droperidol to 10 of Compazine and found better pain relief with droperidol. Now, as I have mentioned in several prior podcasts, my love for droperidol has no limits. I mourn its absence from my hospital on a daily basis, and I feel the need to have a moment of silence every day because I can't get that wonder drug for my paramedics. And by the way, that whole FDA black box thing against droperidol, well, that's just crap. And there are quite a few papers to show it. And I've linked all of the references to this section in our show notes. So if you're looking for a bibliography, that's a great first place to start. So we know droperidol works well, but we can't get it, at least here in the U.S. I'm continuously envious of my Australian colleagues who get that stuff all the time. Well, Haldol is similar to droperidol. It's in the same butorphanol, and I know that I'm saying that wrong. It's in the same class as droperidol, so maybe we could use that instead. Now, there was a study that compared it to metoclopramide and found they were equally effective. And there was a very small study that compared Haldol to placebo and found it to be more effective than placebo. But that was a really small study, and we need an RCT. Fortunately, that's exactly what we have in our current paper. So today's paper is called Treatment of Headache in the Emergency Department, Haloperidol in the Acute Setting, the HA Study, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This paper by Dr. Jessica McCoy and colleagues was published in Journal of Emergency Medicine this year. So let's go through the meat of this paper. This was a single-center randomized control trial of haloperidol versus placebo in a convenient sample of emergency department patients between 13 years old and 55 years old with either headache or migraine as their chief complaint. Patients were enrolled between 2015 and 2016. Patients were excluded if they had any red flags for severe headache, things like fever or confusion, abnormal mental status exam, thunderclap onset. They also excluded you if you had any history of subarachnoid hemorrhage or aneurysm, mass, that type of thing. Now, after obtaining informed consent, patients were randomized to receive either 2.5 milligrams of haloperidol mixed in 5 milliliters of saline, or a placebo dose of only 5 milliliters of normal saline. And both of those were given slowly over 1 to 2 minutes. Now, we know that's important because the faster you give the medicine, these anti-dopaminergic agents, the faster you give them, the more likely you are to get side effects. And the biggest side effect is akathisias, that sensation of restlessness or anxiety. Their primary outcome was the change in pain score at 30, 60, and 90 minutes compared to baseline. Secondary outcomes were time to relief, degree of relief, side effects, QTC prolongation, and 24-hour ED return visits. If they needed a rescue medication, they got 30 of ketorolac. All right, so what did they find? First, I have to say the results section of this paper made my damn head hurt. These authors were really let down by the editor of this journal and their peer reviewers. The results were scattered all over the prose section, and there was not what I call the money table. The money table describes the main results that we care about. It is the one place you can go and get all of the data you want. There was no money table. And that's sad because I think they have some good results here. Unfortunately, I just had to work way too hard to pull them out of this poorly written section. So ultimately, they screened 287 patients to enroll 118, and they got 60 in placebo and 58 in the Haldol group. The two groups were pretty similar, and that indicates the randomization strategy worked well. They found a bigger reduction in pain with haloperidol than placebo, which is kind of the important part. But more importantly to me, anyway, they found a larger proportion of patients with at least a 50% reduction in pain at 30 minutes. They found 35% versus 12% with placebo. And if you take that out to 60 minutes, the difference was even bigger, 65 with Haldol and 22 with placebo. The reason I think that's more important is if you ask a patient whether they care if their pain score dropped from 10 to 9.5, they're just going to look at you funny. On the other hand, if you say, is it important for you to have your pain dropped in half? They're going to be much more willing to say that's the thing that they care about. All right, so they also found what patients would prefer even more is to say, hey, I got rid of the pain altogether. And they looked at that and they found 59% of patients in the haloperidol group had complete resolution of symptoms. Now, I'd love to tell you how that compared with placebo, but they did not report that. Did I mention how disappointed I am in this results section? So bad. You know they had that piece of information. They just didn't. I'm sure the authors just forgot to put it in, but the peer review and the editor should have caught that. Now, haloperidol did have more side effects than placebo at 30 minutes, and the biggest of that was akathisia. But oddly enough, they had fewer side effects at 60 minutes. I'm not really sure what to make of that. The haloperidol group had fewer return ED visits at 24 hours. They had more patients who would want the same drug in the future. So they ask, hey, did you like it? And more people liked it. Now, importantly, because of the bum rap the FDA put on droperidol about the damn EKGs, there was no more QTC prolongation with Haldol than with placebo. And what that suggests to me is we really don't need that damn 12 lead before we give Haldol. Or at least with this dose. So the bottom line in this RCT is that 2.5 milligrams of IV haloperidol is safe and effective for benign headaches. I'm not ready to use this instead of my go-to Reglan or Compazine. And the one I use really depends on which one I can actually get at the moment because there are back orders of both. But I do think this approach, 2.5 of Haldol, is a very reasonable treatment. For me anyway, for those patients who have failed Reglan or failed Compazine or have some other reason not to receive them. All right, so that's what the literature says about the treatment of headache. Let's switch gears now and talk about it in the context of a case. I had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Aaron Lincoln. Dr. Lincoln is a paramedic and a newly minted PGY2 EM resident. That means she just finished her intern year. So I ran her through a simulated oral boards case of a patient with a headache, and she really helps cover some great clinical pearls in a concise format. I think you're going to find this next section really helpful. Dr. Aaron Lincoln, thank you so much for joining us on EMS Lighthouse Project.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I've known you for quite a while. I think the first time I met you, you were a paramedic instructor at Temple College. You were teaching EMT classes and you were doing some flipped classrooms. That was actually the first time I'd ever heard of that concept. You then went to medical school at Texas A&M and you are now a brand new, newly minted PGY2 in emergency medicine in Austin. So the thing that I constantly mess up, because the hospital that you primarily practice at will ever be ingrained in my brain as Brackenridge. Mm-hmm. Can you please tell me what the official word for your residency program is?
Well, let me see if I can get it right. UT Del Seton Hospital. It's essentially UT Austin residency program.
Let's just get to the important shit here. Are you planning on doing an EMS fellowship?
Absolutely.
Outstanding. All right. That is what I wanted to hear. Let's start off. I think some of our listeners are pretty knowledgeable about the road that physicians have to go through to get board certified. But if anyone is not, in addition to doing 3 or 4 years of emergency medicine residency training, you have to go through the board certification process. And part of that is oral boards. So you basically have to dress up and go hang out at what we call ABIM General, or at least this is what we did in the pre-COVID era. And you would stand around in your dress suit looking at other people in hotel rooms, knock on the door and walk in. And yes, by the way, it is extraordinarily awkward. You and this other person in a hotel room sitting across from each other, and they will present a case and then walk you through how to do that case. So they do several types of these. They do singles, they do doubles, and I think there's either one or two triples. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is you have either one patient that you're treating at a time, two patients, or three patients. So we're going to go through one of those, but we're going to do a single. And unfortunately, the case is something that you have probably taken care of at least once or twice a shift in the emergency department.
Okay. All right.
You ready to go?
I'm ready. Bring it.
All right. So you have a patient who checks in, you check on the board, 45-year-old female, and the chief complaint is headache.
You're right. I think you looked at my board from yesterday.
I'm sorry. All I saw was COVID, headache.
Yep. Yeah. And you picked the headache. So that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first thing that I like to do is kind of get my general impression from the door. So as I'm walking in, what do I see, hear, and smell?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, first off, what you do not see is a nurse running around panicked and telling you sick person. So that's very good. Your general impression of the person is she is uncomfortable. She's in a dark room wearing sunglasses, not talking a whole lot, not moving a whole lot. But when you talk to her, she seems to be alert. She responds appropriately, and you don't see, other than the sunglasses in a dark room, no obvious distress.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to ask my nurse if I do have one available, and we don't already have a set of vital signs, and have my patient monitor to sort of get all of that attached so that I can have that going while I'm assessing my patient.
You bet. So the triage vital signs were a blood pressure of 145 over 78, a heart rate of 102 in regular, and you see a normal sinus rhythm versus a sinus tachycardia on the monitor, no ectopy. Respiratory rate is 16, and her pulse matches the monitor. SpO2 is 99%, and not that this would ever actually happen in the real world, but you have an end-tidal CO2 on the Draeger, and it's 28.
Excellent. Okay, 28. That's a little bit on the lower side, but especially with a respiratory rate of 16. But that's okay. It sounds like my patient is awake enough that she's talking. So I'll introduce myself and ask her name.
You bet. Hi, Dr. Lincoln. My name is Jan.
Hey, Jan. Okay, so right now I know that her airway is intact. She's breathing. I know her vital signs are stable, so her ABCs are intact.
Correct.
So I need to do any immediate resuscitation. The next thing I'm going to do is work to rule out the really scary causes of a headache. So my two big worries with that are subarachnoid hemorrhage. Meningitis is also up there.
Very good.
So, hey, Jan, I'm sorry that you're having a headache. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
You bet. This is, it just feels like this throbbing pain. It's over here on the left. It's kind of back behind my eye. It's miserable. It's been going on for a while and I can't get any sleep.
Gosh, I'm so sorry about that. Can you tell me more about how that headache started?
You bet. Well, it just, has kind of been getting worse over the past few days. I took some Tylenol and it just didn't really seem to help.
Okay. And, have you had any fevers with this?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Have you ever had a headache like this before?
Well, this one's probably a little more severe, but I get headaches pretty frequently.
Okay.
Usually the Tylenol will work. Sometimes it doesn't, though.
Okay. So a couple things that I'm thinking right now. The headache doesn't sound like it came on all of a sudden. It doesn't sound like that sort of thunderclap description that we're worried about with the subarachnoid hemorrhage. So I'm less worried about that right now. She doesn't have a fever with it, so I'm a little bit less worried about meningitis. So I'll get a little bit more history. Sounds like she's got headaches in the past. With the lights off and the sunglasses, my thinking is that it's more likely to be sort of a migraine type presentation at this point. But I'm going to keep asking questions to make sure. So, right, Jan, any other symptoms to go along with this headache?
Yeah, I've been throwing up quite a bit. And I'll tell you what, just even when you open the door, the light came in, it really makes this headache worse.
Gosh, I'm so
Thank
sorry.
Thank you so much for being soft-spoken, because the last time I was in here, there's a great big old burly man doctor, and he yelled and screamed, and it really made my head worse.
Wow, I'm really sorry about that. His name wasn't Jeff, was it?
It was.
Oh, gosh.
It was that Jarvis.
Man, yeah, he's trouble. He's trouble. Well, I'm sorry that you're feeling so sick to your stomach. Do you take any medicines or have any medical problems?
I do. I have asthma, and I take an albuterol puffer just a couple times when I need it. And I also have high blood pressure. I take lisinopril for that once a day.
Okay. And you've been able to get that and take that regularly?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very good about it. I never miss a dose.
Okay. With this headache, have you noticed any changes in your vision?
Well, other than the light really making my headache worse, no, I can see fine.
Okay. Any weakness or numbness or tingling anywhere?
No, not really.
Okay, good deal. And I know you said no fevers, but you haven't been sick at all recently?
No, I was feeling fine up until about 2 days ago when this started.
Okay. And there wasn't anything in particular you were doing when it started?
No, honestly, if you really must know, I was sitting there watching reality TV. I'm not proud of that, but I was.
Okay. And I know you...
By reality TV, I mean the news, so...
The news, yeah. That would give me a headache, too. I'm real sorry about that. Have you ever had any evaluation for your headaches in the past?
You know, I see my primary care doctor, and that's about it.
Okay. All right. So nobody's ever gotten any pictures of your head?
No.
So at this point, my thinking is I don't really hear any red flag symptoms. Those would be things like the really sudden onset, the fever. I'll get to my physical exam in a minute, but you know, one of the things to look for is like a stiff neck. That would be worrisome for actually either a subarachnoid or a meningitis type picture. Let's see. Other things that I kind of think about with headache in general, other than the migraines or like a tension headache. Obviously, if she's watching the news, I think all of us have those right now.
Amen.
But then there's some, you know, other weird things like, you know, young women can get this pseudotumor cerebri that's weird. And that tends to cause vision changes, which she didn't have.
We could talk about that a little bit more, but how would you, in your assessment, how would you determine whether she might have that?
Have the pseudotumor?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I would look for is vision changes. That's one of the telling symptoms. And then I would do a fundoscopic exam, which is something they theoretically taught us all how to do in medical school. But I think in practice, it's pretty difficult.
Anything on your just gross physical exam from across the room that might help you?
So sometimes these patients can be overweight.
Okay.
And then the other kind of characteristic thing is young women who take birth control pills.
Yeah. And she is, her BMI is, let's say, 25. She's like a normal size, kind of skinny for a Texan, actually, but pretty normal looking person.
Well, she's in Austin. She's probably vegan. So that explains it.
Yeah. There is a slight smell of patchouli in the room.
All right. So knowing that I have those differentials in the back of my head, I've already gotten my vital signs, so I'm going to kind of move on with my physical exam.
And I think I lied to you. I did not give you a temperature, and it's 98.6.
Oh, perfect. You're right. You did lie to me.
I did.
Okay. So good.
I'm a lying liar.
So when I have somebody with a headache, you know, I kind of do my usual sort of general assessment. And I think we've already talked through that. She's sitting up. She's awake. I don't notice any kind of gross, you know, trauma. And I guess that's something I didn't ask her about, is that she didn't have any trauma.
No, she is not.
Good. And then I usually do a heart and lung exam on everybody.
You bet.
But
regular rate, rhythm, number, reserves, or gallops, and cleared auscultation bilaterally.
Perfect. I think the money here is on the neurologic exam. And my neurologic exam, I do a full assessment of cranial nerves. I check for strength in the, you know, upper or lower extremities. I check what we call cerebellar tests, you know, check balance.
Tell me a little bit more about those.
The cerebellar tests?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you test those? What do you do?
So the first thing I do is I do the finger to nose test, And that is where I hold up my finger and then I ask the patient to touch their nose and then touch my finger. And then we repeat that and I move my hand around and make sure that they accurately touch my finger, that they don't go past it. And that also lets me assess for sort of tremors at that point as well.
Okay.
I have them make a sandwich out of their hands. So both palms go together and then they hold their hands, I guess, parallel to the floor so that they're kind of playing patty cake with themselves, I guess, is what they're going to do. So they'll take their hand and have them flip it back and forth as fast as they can.
Okay.
And I'm looking to see that they can do it smoothly and pretty rapidly. And switch sides, do the same thing and kind of compare the speed and how smooth they move on both sides. The last thing that I'll do is if I can get them to stand up and walk, that'll be the next thing because that'll let me assess their balance really well. Just kind of walk normally. I'll have them walk on their tiptoes, walk on their heels, and then walk toe to heel, like the other drunk test. And if they can't do that, if they're not able to stand up for whatever reason, I can have them drag their heel along their shin. So have them put their heel at their knee on their shin and just have them kind of trace their shin down to their ankle. Do that on both sides. And with that, I'm just looking again to see that they're doing it smoothly and that they're able to kind of keep their foot on that path.
So when you do your neurologic exam, you've already determined she is alert. She's talking to you. She's oriented. Her pupils are equal and reactive to light. Extraocular muscles are intact. She has good, no field deficits. She can smile at you, stick her tongue out. She can poof her cheeks out. She can move her head to the left and the right, and she can shrug her shoulders. She passes all of your coordination tests, finger to nose and rapid alternating are good. She stands up, walks well, and does not fall to the ground when you have her close her eyes and hold her arm out in front of her. So now that you have done that, what would you like to do?
If I'm able to do a fundoscopic exam, if I have all the available tools, it would be nice to try and take a look in the back of her eye.
You bet. There is the 30-year-old otoscope and ophthalmoscope on the little Welch Allyn thing on the wall. One of them has a light bulb in it. God only knows which one.
Yeah.
And the patient has two eyeballs.
Cool. Well, I'm going to do my best to hopefully use the light bulb in the ophthalmoscope since that's the one that always works. Because we only ever use the one in looking ears. And I'm going to...
If you're going to be honest about it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So when you do a fundoscopic exam, in general, what are you looking for?
Papilledema is the one, is the big thing that I'm worried about. There are a few other findings that might kind of clue me into like blood pressure or diabetes, but the big one that I'm worried about is what we call papilledema or swelling at the optic disc.
Okay. Now that you have finished all of your exam, you notice that her blood pressure has cycled again and is now 160 over 94.
You know, there I think are a couple of reasons potentially for that. She's hurting. You know, I think that's probably the most likely reason. I've just finished my exam. I haven't found anything else wrong that would make me worried that she's got some like hypertensive encephalopathy. Presumably she's awake and talking to me at that point.
Correct. She seems to be pretty with it. Kind of miserable, but pretty with it.
Well, I should really do something about that being miserable.
Should probably like that. Press Ganey scores and all.
Yeah. Yeah. They like it when we take care of, you know, what they came in for.
Absolutely. So how do you want to do that? What do you want to give her?
Yeah. So my kind of go-to cocktail, I like IV fluids. I think they help. Even with the hypertension, a little bit of IV fluids might be helpful. I like to use ketorolac. I think NSAIDs are good. And the IV NSAID, I think maybe it's just placebo using the IV NSAID. Maybe it really does actually get in and help faster.
So when you say, let's just clarify a little bit, you said IV fluids, what type, how much?
I think our go-to is usually normal saline because that's kind of what everybody picks. And I think I probably just opened up a can of worms with that, discussion. I know there's a lot of discussion about what's the right IV fluid.
Fortunately for you, Erin, that is a different podcast.
Excellent.
And one that I'm not going to do. I am not one of the IV fluid warriors.
Good deal. Yeah. So the IV fluid is the one that we have, which is saline.
Good answer. And how much do you want to give?
You know, 500 to a liter is kind of my go-to unless there's a reason not to give fluid, like congestive heart failure, kidney, you know, person's on dialysis or has other reasons for fluid restriction.
Fair enough. And how did you want to give the ketorolac and how much did you want to give?
I usually do 15 IV. There was some debate at some point about like 30 milligrams sort of used to be the go-to dose. And was too much, but 15 seems to work for most of my patients.
Anything else you want to do?
Yeah, I want to treat her nausea. The other medications that I like are either Compazine or Reglan for the nausea, and that has the double effect of potentially being helpful for the migraine itself. And then I like to give a little Benadryl with it. I think the original thought behind that was to prevent things like dystonic reactions or akathisia that you can get with those other two medicines. But I think it also...
Which two medicines?
The Compazine and the Reglan.
All right. So tell me, if you're going to do Reglan, how much would you give and how would you give it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually have those saved in my favorites, and those doses I do not have committed to memory at this point. So
fair enough. This is what happens when you use an electronic record system.
I know, right? I think one of them's 5 or 10 milligrams for the Reglan. I think Compazine is similar.
Yeah. So 10 to 20 on the Reglan IV and 5 to 10 on Compazine.
There we go.
So anything specific about how you want to give those?
I think our nurses usually actually put those in like a 50 cc IV bag and run them in over a slightly longer period of time.
How about the Benadryl?
That is also given IV and given slowly. We don't want to push that rapidly.
And how much did you want to give?
I usually do 25 because I want my patients to not be completely passed out asleep from the Benadryl.
We'll give that some time and see if you still want that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay. Very good. And so you have your nurse comes in to get you, says you have a major trauma coming in.
Cool.
You go off, you work the 13 COVID patients that you have, intubate a couple of those. And then you're like, all right, it's almost time to sign out. The lady with the headache.
Yep.
So you go back in to check on her.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out she's feeling much better.
Good.
And thanks you profusely, says you are so much better than that Dr. Jarvis guy.
Yeah.
And she's like, can I go home now?
I think so. Do you have a doctor that you can follow up with?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Do you think you'll be able to make an appointment with that doctor for the next couple of days to be seen about your migraines?
Sure.
Perfect.
That's what you think this is a migraine?
I do.
Okay. Yeah, no, I can make an appointment with him.
Good.
Anything special I should do? Anything I should avoid?
Yeah. Have you ever noticed that there is any foods in particular that trigger your migraines? Maybe cheeses, wines?
Nah, not really.
No. Okay.
Thank God I can still drink wine without any problem.
That would be really rough to get
Did I mention the news?
Yeah. The news.
Yeah.
Can stop watching the news for a little bit. That might help your migraines.
That's a good point. Now my blood pressure went up while I was in here. Do you think that I need to raise my blood pressure medicine? Do you think my high blood pressure is what's causing my headaches?
Well, high blood pressure can sometimes cause headaches. I am not going to change your blood pressure medication right now. That's the other thing I think would be good for you to follow up, with your primary care doctor about, so they can keep checking that and make adjustments as necessary.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Lincoln. I want to go home now.
Okay. All right. Do you have a safe way to get home?
Yeah, I do. My husband's out front.
Perfect.
So perfect. Erin, thank you so much. You did very well.
Oh, good. I passed.
You did great. The key things that you need to do, and you do this with all of your patients and you verbalize this really well, is you need to get a general impression. Where on the oh shit-ometer is this patient? And they were pretty far down on the left in the green on the oh shit-ometer. You weren't terribly worried. Your best sign was that your nurse was not worried. And I will take the general impression over a paramedic or a nurse any day. It's really hard to practice efficiently without them. You got a good set of vital signs. You went through and you verbalized your differential diagnosis. Key things you got to look for, as you mentioned, subarachnoid hemorrhage, other versions of intercerebral hemorrhage, things that might make those a little bit more common, really old people, which she wasn't, really alcoholic people, and then folks on blood thinners, and she wasn't on any of those.
Right.
So you did a good job with that. You verbalized and asked her about all of the red flags, things like fever, sudden onset at maximal intensity, and you used the phrase thunderclap headache, which is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You asked what they were doing when that started. And as you know, a headache that comes on at maximal intensity, specifically during or immediately after exertion, is really bad. That's a key indicator for subarachnoid hemorrhage. And you ask about focal neurologic deficits. All of those are really important. The one thing that I talk about, and this is one of these things that you always see, you treat your last patient, is neck pain, headache coming, radiating down into the neck, particularly that comes on, say right after chiropractic manipulation. So looking for a vertebral artery dissection.
Absolutely.
You also mentioned pseudotumor cerebri or benign cerebral inner.
Yeah.
God, what is the new one? Intercerebral, no, that's not it. Intercranial hypertension.
I think that's right. Benign intercranial hypertension.
There you go.
I might have made that up.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So the key things, as you mentioned, looking for there is the great big obese people. And the fact that they may have some visual disturbances from basically you would, if either one of us were good at fundoscopic exams, you'd see the papilledema. And then they probably have had a history of having lumbar punctures for this. So for the longest time, we felt like draining their CSF, which is the foundation of this. They either produce more or don't absorb it. And they get this increase in intracerebral fluid production. That's what causes it. So we thought draining it was a good thing. And turns out that doesn't work very well. Yeah, you may give some relief, but about 6 hours later, they've already made that CSF back again. So probably treat them like you do anybody else. You did a great job going over your neurologic exam, and that's really, it sounds like it took a long time to go over that, but that's because you're verbalizing it. When you do that on every single patient, you can get that done. And unless the patient really wants to chat, you can knock it out in easily under 5 minutes, usually 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of that's getting them from sitting to standing when they have a headache.
And getting them all disconnected from the 15 million things we have on them.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yep.
And then finally, you talked about a migraine cocktail. And so the first thing that I want to let you know is there is a wrong answer, and that's opioids.
Right. Absolutely.
And then there are a whole bunch of things that are right answers. And most of them involve the pain got better and you didn't give them an opioid. So the reason that we talk about opioids is primarily not because opioids don't help the headache. They do. You give somebody Dilaudid, which incidentally is the number one drug given in the emergency department for headaches. And it's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. It works. It shuts them up. They feel stoned and they go home. The problem is you can get these, the opioids actually make the problem worse. And classically, docs will prescribe hydrocodone, and that's a bad idea. You mentioned IV fluids. So IV fluids, typically, at least from a literature standpoint, have not shown to benefit headaches. Now, having said that, I do it anyway. There's something mad, just like a banana bag. Banana bag very rarely helps, but there's something magic about the yellow. It seems to like it. It's a crowd pleaser, so I use it. Ketorolac. So a guy named Sergey Motov did this really cool study where he compared 10 milligrams to 15 milligrams to 30 milligrams of IV ketorolac, and that's Toradol, by the way. And there was no added benefit to anything over 10. So I typically do 10. The classic was 30. It's style points and how much of a EBM Nazi you want to be. And since I run this podcast, you'd probably guess what I give. Mm-hmm. You talked about Reglan, which is metoclopramide, and Compazine, which is, I can never say this, prochlorperazine.
Yep.
Those are anti-dopaminergic agents, and they are the first line in migraine or any headache, benign headache, and they work really, really well. Some other anti-dopaminergics are Haldol, like we're reviewing in this paper, and droperidol. Droperidol is a wonderful drug. Unfortunately, we just can't get it much anymore. You talked about diphenhydramine or Benadryl. The main reason we do that, there are two reasons. One is to treat the akathisias or the sense of restlessness or anxiety that comes on when you give these anti-dopaminergic agents too rapidly. It's a form of extrapyramidal symptoms or EPS. And the treatment for it is an anticholinergic, and Benadryl is a dirty drug, and it has a lot of anticholinergic properties. So it treats that really well too. The one you'll always see in the textbook, but never actually in the Pyxis, is Cogentin or Benztropin. And good luck getting that. The patient will have gotten up and walked out from their akathisias long before you ever give Cogentin. Some other things that can help, magnesium sometimes can help, caffeine. Giving IV caffeine is kind of fun to do. Sort of interferes with the sleeping. And that's the second thing Benadryl does, is put them to sleep. And if they've been awake for 3 days, sleeping probably helps them. And then now folks are using some ketamine. And I've only done it once, and boy, did they like it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as ballsy a move as it sounds like. It turns out this patient was well-established in our migraine clinic and actually had in their Epic note a thing from their neurologist saying, listen, try the normal stuff, but when that doesn't work, try a ketamine infusion.
Excellent. I was wondering if we'd make it through the whole podcast without a mention of ketamine.
Of course. Well, we might have, because, you know, I got to say droperidol here.
Yeah. You know, I can get droperidol in my place.
Yeah, but can you use it?
Well, I have to ask really nice and only yeah. if I've tried five other things for nausea.
So I will tell you, this is a light at the end of the tunnel thing. It makes a huge difference when it's a PGY-15 asking as opposed to a PGY-2.
That is so true. Someday I'll be there.
That's right. You'll get there. Well, awesome. Aaron, I think we have done, I think that's a great exposure to perhaps some of our folks about what you have to do at ABIM General, what an oral board is like. And it can be a bit nerve-wracking. And you did a great job of verbalizing it. And basically you get this, I think, probably much better than all of your classmates, because you ran scenarios for your EMT and paramedic students.
That I did.
Exactly the same.
Yep.
So most of my classmates freaked the hell out about the orals. And for me, it was kind of fun because it was just the same thing we've done for years.
Yeah. I feel the same way. It's kind of a fun challenge to talk through things and see what you find and, you know, hear maybe what you missed when you get the feedback. So it's fun.
You did great. Well, thank you again. I think we managed to actually hit everything we wanted to talk about. So thank you so much, and good luck in your second year, particularly in Austin, which is COVID central outside of Houston. So I know Central Texas is doing the best we can to catch up with Houston, unfortunately.
Yeah. Everybody, I'm glad I've seen a lot of masks this weekend. That's been nice.
Yeah. Thank you again.
Absolutely. You too, sir.
What a great interview. Nice job, Dr. Lincoln and Jeff. Great job. It always just makes my heart warm to see those old paramedics now being doctors. There's just something about, I know so many of them. We're seeing them so much more often, and this is great to get on here with us and talking about this. I thought it was great.
Absolutely. And you say back on the podcast, even though this was her first take, I do think that we will have her back on.
Oh, yeah.
I was very impressed. So it has been a long time since I've gone through an oral boards case. I did those when I first certified in 2009, I guess I did. My time at ABIM General, as we say, and I immediately did what everybody does who doesn't have to put up with anything anymore, and I put it out of my memory.
Yeah.
But I think she did really well with that case. I think she did a great job talking her way through things and explaining what her thought process was. For anybody who's listening out there, if you are a student of any kind and have to go through oral scenarios, if you have
national paramedic students.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. National Registry orals. As an examiner myself, where I examine people, that's what we want you to do. So I think Aaron was a great role model there.
Yeah, I absolutely love those oral scenarios. I mean, you don't have the usual cues around. I know we're getting in the weeds a little bit, but I just got to give it the props that are due, because, like I said, you don't have the visual cues around you. Oh, I'd take a blood pressure because you see a cuff sitting there or whatever. You really have to be on your game to successfully navigate an oral board or an oral test. And I just love that. Anyway, a couple things about the study and the interview that I thought were pretty interesting. So if you're going to have to read the study to see some of these nuances there, and these are just little Mikeyisms, I'll call them, that I thought were kind of cute or sort of interesting about the study. And the one of them was that they didn't enroll people between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m.
That's right. Didn't they?
They just don't have the staff at that time. So there was no pharmacist around. And so they didn't do it. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. I like the way they used envelopes to randomize the patients, whether they were going to get, the placebo or the Haldol. I thought that was kind of cute as well. And cute, maybe not the right description of that, but, it's just little things that I pick up on. And boy, a lot of women a lot of women. And that brings me kind of back to my story about Michelle was like, I never have headaches, but for some reason she gets them all the time. And there was a lot of women that were part of the study.
Yeah, absolutely. And it turns out if you look at the epidemiology of headaches, so migraines are not the only type of headache.
Sure.
You always have lots of other types, but women are more likely to have headaches that require treatment. Not sure why that is. Maybe estrogen plays a role. There are some headaches that seem to correspond cyclically with menstruation or ovulation. It looks like overall in the general population, the incidence is around 1 in 6 Americans will have these, but it drops down to 1 in 5 women. So women, it's not unusual. The reason, I think that's reflective of just the disease pathology.
Yeah, for sure. I would totally agree with that. And just a couple other things that I thought were interesting there was, I love the fact that they were checking, these different metrics at 0 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, and really seeing where they're at. And I think Haldol just proved itself that, like, there was no question, at least in this particular study, that might be just the way to go, right? Pretty safe, pretty effective. Not a lot of rescues needed. There's a table in there that talks about, that breaks everything down about who needed a rescue after a certain amount of time. I think it was 60 minutes. And the placebo group, I think it was 41 out of 60 or something like that, or 41 out of 48 needed a rescue from there. So placebo doesn't work. And in this case, it was normal saline. Wasn't doing the job apparently, but there was a small percentage of people that went, you know what? I feel pretty good after that. Thank you very much.
Absolutely, man. And that, I think you see that in every placebo controlled study.
Yeah.
So when we say placebo, the placebo effect is very real.
Very real.
It is a psychological impact. When you think you are getting a treatment, very often you get better. It doesn't work so well with, say, orthopedic surgery, where you're talking about healing a fracture. A little eye of newt and toe of frog on there probably didn't work real well.
Yeah.
All sorts of pain. Pain in general is so susceptible to placebo effect, which is the reason whatever I'm doing, if I'm giving a treatment, I'm going to sell it. And the reason I'm selling it is just part of it is because I'm enhancing the effect. I want to get as much benefit as possible. And I want to bring in that placebo effect. Now, for a variety of reasons, if you look at the ethics, treating someone with a placebo and telling them it is real is actually unethical. So we can't do that. But I do sell the effectiveness of the treatment. Hey, we got this great drug. I really think it's going to help. Every time I admit a patient. So, I admitted somebody the other day. Dr. Khan, he is a great doctor, and it turns out he actually is. But I'll say Dr. Khan is a great doctor. They'll take great care of you. Dr. Eckford is a wonderful surgeon. If I had to have my appendix out,
he's the one.
I wouldn't want doing it. Dr. Divakaran, incredible cardiologist. If I got to have somebody stick a needle in my groin and go up into my heart, I want Vijay doing it, which again has the benefit of being true. But I'm going to sell it because I want them to be comfortable in the team that's taken care of.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. But, and finally, there were a bunch of things that we talked about as red flags within this paper. And so, Dr. Mm-hmm. Jarvis, what makes you think of some of these diagnoses that were described in the paper? I'll just throw a couple out to you. Something like meningitis or a bleed of some kind. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So let's just play buzzword bingo,
okay,
which is sort of a word association. If you're thinking about meningitis, you really need to be thinking about headache. And incidentally, one of the best physical exams for meningitis, and I had this in the emergency department yesterday, really good, nice kid. He's a kid, 25 years old. He had meningitis when he was 16, and now he's got musculoskeletal neck pain, and he's worried it's meningitis. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I gave him the full meal deal, the full neuro exam. I put on the show. And then I had him stand up and do jumping jacks. That's called jolt attenuation. If you can jump up and down, putting weight landing on your heel, that just sends a shock straight up your spinal cord. If you have meningitis, you will definitely know it. And he's just bouncing away. And I'm like, man, you don't have meningitis.
I haven't seen a similar thing with appendicitis.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly the same way. Jolt attenuation, very good sensitivity for anything with peritonitis.
Sure, sure.
So when it comes to subarachnoid, the thing that I think about is sudden onset at maximal intensity, and that's the thunderclap headache. So the headache that goes from no headache to horrible headache within the span of a few minutes. That is a subarachnoid until we can prove otherwise. And we talked a little bit about when you were sharing Michelle's story about how we would go about doing that. The one question I do not ask is this the worst headache of your life? And the reason I bring that up is a lot of us were trained to ask that.
Yeah.
And we think, well, that's a question we can ask. Therefore, we should do that in the field because we don't have to have, we don't have the other diagnostic modalities. Well, it turns out you still can take a history, and not asking that question allows you to take a better history. So put yourself in your patient's position. They know that a headache isn't a gunshot wound. There's not a knife sticking out of their belly. They may be feeling a little hesitant about calling 911 for a headache anyway, feeling a little embarrassed. So you're almost asking them to inflate the severity of the headache. So they basically say is, of course, if it wasn't the worst headache of my life, why would I? Yeah. So sudden onset, maximal intensity. And then the last one is carotid artery dissection. So the things that I associate with that, chiropractic manipulation, pain radiating down the neck. So down the, like right around where the carotid artery is. Those are the things I think of there. So another way to look at how do you make sure you don't miss those can't miss diagnoses is look for red flags. And what are the red flags that you took away from this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a few, right? And they really go right back to our can't miss diagnosis. So fever, right? If they come in with a headache and a fever, well, then you kind of put those pieces together. You're kind of looking at stuff. Obviously, any altered mental status, focal neurodeficits, or as you described, maybe that thunderclap headache. Those, for me, those were the red flags.
So, Mike, when you were going through the literature review, there was a lot in there. All of the professional guidelines say avoid opioids. What's the takeaway? What did you take away about why to avoid opioids?
Well, it seemed pretty clear that, you know, you have an increased length of stay in the ED. You have more hospital admissions. You get more people actually coming back to the ED because their headaches have returned. And so that's not very good. You run the risk of increasing their normal migraines, right? So maybe they have, you know, let's say two a week. Now all of a sudden they're going to have four a week or whatever it may be. So we know that it increases those daily migraines. And of course that decreases their quality of life. And so, you know, I think to me, those are all great reasons to probably try to avoid opiates.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. And it turns out they just don't work as well as some of the other treatments.
Yeah.
And I'll just go over those real quickly. And then I have a couple of other funky ones. So the main class, so we got the NSAIDs, and even though there is IV acetaminophen now, mm-hmm. it's ungodly expensive.
It certainly is.
The NSAIDs as a class is one, so ketorolac. And we did talk in the interview about the dosing, so 10 milligrams of IV ketorolac, no added benefit for 15 or 30. And then the hallmark here is the anti-dopaminergic agents. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at metoclopramide, which is Reglan, or prochlorperazine, which is Compazine. And 10 milligrams of either one of those does the trick. The big side effect from the anti-dopaminergic agents, but particularly those, is the akesthesias. The way to avoid the akesthesias is give it slowly, way more slowly than you have patience for. So just stick it in 50 or 100 mils and run it in.
Nice and easy. Yeah, that makes sense. And if you've never seen that, the minute you see your patient doing it, you will know that's what they're doing. It is an unbelievable thing to see, because I've seen it one time in my 25 years. And when I saw it, there was no question. I knew exactly what I was looking at.
Absolutely. And it's a miserable sensation. Yeah. They feel like they're coming out of their skin.
Yeah.
So if they do have it, Mikey, what do we want to treat them?
I'm going to give them some Benadryl, and it will just take right good care of them.
So the fascinating thing is the reason that works is if you look at the particularly the – God, let me see if I can remember the – I'm probably going to mispronounce it, but I believe it's the negrostriatal area of the brain. And basically you have – this is the area that affects muscle movement, so not intentional muscle movement. Mm-hmm. It helps coordinate it. And you have this balance between acetylcholine and dopamine. And you've blocked the effect of dopamine with these drugs. And you have a preponderance of acetylcholine activity. And that can work on those muscarinic receptors. and that leads to more muscle activity. And Benadryl we don't think about it as an anticholinergic. It's an antihistamine, but the truth is it's a dirty drug, and it also has anticholinergic properties. And it turns out when you overdose on Benadryl, Cogentin is the other one, but God only knows we never have that. Droperidol, and let's just go ahead and take a moment of silence, Mikey.
I know you miss it.
Sad drug. So droperidol is great. Haloperidol, as we covered in this study, I still don't think it's as good as droperidol, and in my experience, not as good as Regalan or Compazine. But when I give those and they fail, I'm going to go to Haldol. And then what I call the kitchen sink. So headaches aren't breaking. What is some other weird shit I can do? I can throw some mag their way. I can do steroids. Now, it turns out steroids, this is a trick question, steroids don't help that headache. But what they do is decrease rebound headaches. Yeah. So if you're giving steroids, it's not to help treat that headache. It's to help prevent future headaches.
I can see that. Makes sense.
And then some really weird things you can do if it's a tension headache. You can do trigger point injections. If they're having a lot of stress and tension in their neck coming up into the back of their head, and that's giving them a headache, which is very common, you can actually do a nerve block just with lidocaine or bupivacaine right around the occipital prominence. And that hits those nerves coming up the back of your head. You can also do a sphenopalatine nerve block. Now, Mikey, you should be very familiar with the sphenopalatine nexus. So that is a group of nerves that control a fair amount of your face. And the reason you should be familiar with it,
because they jammed a swab up my nose to test me about 10 days ago.
They did. And when it got really uncomfortable,
yeah,
well, that's because they're just poking away at
yes,
that.
Yes, they were.
So the way you do it is the way it's supposed to be done anyways. Take a swab saturated in lidocaine, put it back there,
hold it
and leave it for about 10 minutes. That is not the way I do it because that makes me hurt just thinking about it. So I just do nasal lidocaine and really play up the placebo effects of it. And then last but not least, you can do some ketamine infusions. This is not standard of care by any means, but some of our neurologists are doing this and it seems to really help.
Wow. Fascinating stuff. It's interesting because I bet you if we were to poll the audience, they probably don't see a lot of headaches pre-hospitally. They might, but chances are they're probably not going to come in by EMS. But I will tell you, this kind of information is super helpful when you're dealing with anything inside that head, right? I mean, being able to realize some of this stuff, look at understanding what some of these red flags are, what is a normal treatment, some diagnoses to be aware of as it pertains to neuro stuff. And I think this was a great podcast.
I was really excited about it. And it was awesome to have Dr. Lincoln on. First off, I'm really proud of her and I'm biased because she's my friend, but I'm proud to see a paramedic go through med school and she's doing well in residency. I'm very excited for her, but I think she did a great oral presentation and hopefully we'll have her back and do some more of those things.
Absolutely. Well, so, do you have any final thoughts before I get us on out of here?
I do. The biggest thing, I have an ask.
Oh.
I have an ask for our audience.
Okay.
This is the first time we have done an oral review like this, an oral board, and I want to know what you think about it. Is this something that helps condense the topic and helps get to the takeaway point? So please give me your feedback. I want to know, do you like this? Do you want more of it?
Yeah, I love that. So we're also going to throw out a quick plug. We're going to be live on Friday, July 10th at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we are going to be test driving a brand new platform. And we're going to be live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, and Twitter all at the same time. We'll be simulcasting to all those. So it's at Flight Bridge Ed on all of them. So whether you're following us on Twitter, go to the Flight Bridge Ed Twitter page. Boom. It's going to be broadcast right there. Twitch, same thing, at Flight Bridge Ed. I think we're going to have the whole gang on there, I hope. At least going to be you, me, Ritu, Eric, Bruce, Dave Olvera. I don't know. We'll see who else shows up. Maybe Ashley. It'll be great.
I'll bet Ashley. Hopefully Ashley can come.
I hope she jumps on there. It's going to be great. Just a little happy hour. So grab yourself a beverage, whatever it may be. Maybe a little Toco Picho. What is that stuff you call it there in Texas?
It is, it's my drink is a little of the cheap scotch. So Dewar and Topo Chico.
Topo Chico. Right. Exactly. All right.
And that's just for my buddy, John Gonzalez, who, always accuses me of stealing his culture with my drinking of Topo Chico.
I love that. On behalf of Dr. Jeff Jarvis, Mike Verkest, you've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. We are a proud member of the Flight Bridgehead Podcast Network and
a Fire Dog production.
All right. We will see you on the next EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Have a great day, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye, y'all.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the Flight Bridgehead podcast family, and a Fire Dog production. Visit flightbridgehead.com for more information.